Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. In this episode, we're celebrating some of the exceptional writing produced during our annual Poetry Summer School. This Summer School showcase features short readings from Sarah Folkstad, Stephen Blythe, Isabel Jane, Jess McKinney, Lucy Duggan, Ashley Elizabeth Best, Rebecca K. Morrison, Linda Hewitt, Elizabeth McGowan, Daniel Bresland, and Bernie Crawford. It's hosted by Elizabeth McIntosh, with some words of introduction from Seamus Heaney, Chair of Poetry, Nick Laird.
Hello everyone, I just wanted to quickly welcome you all back and thank you once again for all of the insightfulness and generosity you showed towards each other's work back in June, July, whenever it was. Thank you also for reading this evening. I think poets tend to be loners a bit. Yeats talked about poetry as the social act of a solitary man, and writing or reading poetry is a way to be alone without being lonely, but even poets like to come together sometimes, and there was much pleasure in finding like-minded people, in forming even for a week a little guild of poets, and with that, let's get started.
I'm Elizabeth McIntosh. I'm a project assistant for the Seamus Heaney Centre, and I just wanted to thank a couple of people too before we begin. First is Rachel Brown, our centre coordinator. Without her vision and dedication, the summer school would not be possible. I'd also like to thank the Seamus Heaney Centre director, Glenn Patterson, and Nick Laird and the rest of this year's summer school tutors for their commitment to the summer school. And lastly, I'd like to thank Rose Winter for all she's done to support summer school and this reading. We will begin with a reading from Sarah Folkstad, who is joining us from Arvika, Sweden. She's a poet, artist, and educator, and she is part of the feminist art collective Otalt and released a Swedish book of poems in 2021.
I will read a few poems that are all part of the same kind of planned sequence about the forest. The first one is called Forest Late Winter. The stars are animal eyes in the between black of the woods. The first tawny owl calls out of the dark tangle. The beam of my head torch hits a drop of resin, turning it into a microscopic diamond, as small as the one in my first engagement ring from a shop near the Smithfield Market. But much more radiant, carrying the entire wonder of this biotope. On the pink-gray pine trunk, it gleams. I resist the urge to stretch my hand out to pierce the drop's perfection. As resin, it would be insignificant, a whiff of forest on my finger, soon blending with my protein to the point where it is lost. But as a diamond in the night, it is unique and brilliant, waiting in a dark forest until everything is made as bright by the morning. After the spring harvest, I walk the land under the waxing moon, new pine silhouettes clawing at the evening sky. The trees awaiting removal, prone on the curling moss. Their nerves cut off, their smell lingering above the heated ground, suddenly exposed to the day. Tufts of beard lichen line the scars in the ground like lifeless animal fur. This is farmer's land, owner's land, the hand that signed the deed calls the shots. These woods are not mine any more than the air I breathe. The air, the trees, the water seeps up through the pockets of the earth like tears of mercury and lead. This is landowner's land. This is clear-cut land washing away from underneath my feet, the black, greasy peat peeking out from the wounds of forgotten riches. From the top of the tree stump, I blow off the sawdust, like the dust off a record. My fingers record each purr and each abundant year, counting the years until the tips of my fingers become wood. Paths. My body has developed an obsession with finding the old path that I walked for years. Zigzagging between tree stumps and rocks, dead branches scratching my ankles, the bone-white granite bedrock peeking through, guiding me to where I used to lift my foot. I follow the no more path until it becomes real, invoke it until it looks like it always did, a soft track through the forest floor, the trampled moss, the ants hurrying across with today's burden. Shallow spruce roots crossing the path with the longing of pulsating veins. I keep ending up on the wrong side of one of the used to be trees or another. I go back and try again. I walk up to the edge of the still alive forest, glance down the clear-cut slope. I have falcon eyes. They search the route that my feet have failed to find. They squint to erase the tracks of the machine, and then I sprint down the hill, heart first. Why are you standing here like lightning rods? I ask the birch trees after the rain. They have been guarding this place since early spring. The thunderstorm still circling this gentle hill, like a leopard stalking its prey. The heaviness of the air, the rainforest steam rising from the blue woods at the horizon. The ground can't receive the water. Ponds surrounded by rusty moss from another year, another season. The birch trees answer, make exaggerated bows in the gusts of wind. They sprinkle yellow confetti and announce, "Today we welcome to this land hemp nettle, wild raspberry, groundsel, and bracken." They are experts in these suitably disturbed habitats and will take over the previous responsibilities of the ancient pines, who gracefully retired in March. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Sarah. That was beautiful, really haunting images. Next, we'll be hearing from Stephen Blythe, who received his BA in creative writing and philosophy from Georgia State University in 1998. His poetry has appeared in American Poets Abroad, The Blue Monday Review, Crab Creek Review, The Moth Magazine, Permafrost, The Poets Billow, Tulane Review, Tool Review, Wasafiri Magazine, and most recently in 5 Points Magazine. He also served as the contest committee chair for the Poetry Society of Virginia from 2017 to 2019. He lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where he is an MFA candidate in poetry at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. I'm going to be reading 3 poems today, and I'm going to start with a poem titled "The Night Before." There was shuffling in the kitchen, his father's mismanagement of pots and pans. No comment from the old man earlier that day. Stroppy silence as he packed up boxes with agreed upon things. The poplars in their yard had their own long, thin nerves. Shadows climbing up and down the living room wall as in the old films. Their limbs crossed over their coffee table, plates of half-eaten pizza, while his father brought out the s'mores casserole. It smelled that way, he remembered, like desperation, like the same empty smile they shared. It grew dark. They watched the stack of movies late into the night. Next poem is titled "Unlabeled Box." I'm in my chair in the attic space when the boxes I stacked in February topple. A drawing of me wearing sharp triangles for teeth falls out, and I wish I could tell you that it poured forth from the box labeled Halloween 2016. Instead, it fell from the worst box, the unlabeled box. You know this because you drew these teeth of mine after one of the fights, and I know it because I remember finding the box in the trunk underneath the golf clubs when I came to grab the car after the divorce. Maybe the unlabeled box is not your mother's idea of a joke and just a place for random belongings. This wouldn't matter so much to you, not knowing about the box, nor where this drawing of my new terrible teeth might have gone to, my face growing like a large balloon that takes over my stick figure body. You had forgotten all about it by then. This box, just a plain box that has all manner of effects in it, I cannot place. dead batteries, loose change, old candies. When I picked up the car from the roadside in front of our house, it felt as though I was stealing something. The box, I don't know why I keep it. Did you have to make my head so ridiculously round and fat? And then this last poem is titled Finger Painting. Its tempura tongue wet with piercing alien language, its yellow petals peeling apart in the bright spaces, leaving only signs of undeveloped infant fingers. Is this you again? Is this you visiting? Please don't go. It seems the flow of blood might not manage. The smell here is painfully floral, the petals drifting all about again in their damn airy stasis. They tremble. They tremble and oscillate. Oscillate like memory, and I can't seem to reassemble you. The smudges multiply, melting into their own selves.
Thank you, Stephen. Next, we'll be hearing poems from Isabel Jane, who's a secondary school teacher and a poet in her off hours. She's been shortlisted for the Jane Martin Poetry Prize, as well as longlisted in the Bridport and Miss Lexia Poetry Prizes.
I'll be reading three poems this evening. Two relatively short, one a little bit longer, and they're all about the same trip. So the first is called Curlian. We get our auras photographed on Canal Street. I stare bleakly into the box camera. My hands on the plates are sure of shock. The metal is only cold. The woman is brisk and efficient, keener to return to threading obsidian than unveil my secrets to myself, my two friends, and the other customers in this small jewelry shop. We're left lingering around a glass case in the front corner, ignored. Eventually, an unceremonious finger is crooked our way. One friend is bright red, the other blues and purples. I'm red last, my face abject, framed by a streak of tangerine, china pink, royal purple, cyan. She translates, "My life is full of confusion from all directions and will remain so for some time." Our lady is of no sucker, just flat, frank clarity. Indifferently, she recommends a quartz, some sunstone, but nothing for me. We tumble out back into the bustle of the city. I grip the white envelope too tightly, a smudge of a thumbprint left in the corner. When I see it, I am reminded, all directions. My next poem is called On Seeing My Therapist, Jenny Holzer. I drag my stupid little body to stand by a white wall and look at a brass plaque that reminds me to stop hurting myself. The first time, I walk right past, too short to spot it hiding on the inside of a doorway. Sometimes she's soft, dreams full of joy, reminding me to find ways to be tender. In others, she is blunt. Expiring for love is beautiful, but stupid. Protect yourself from what you want. Limit the times you act against your nature. Another time, in another city, I stand under a stairwell papered with inflammatory essays, bold demands for the future. I stare at the letters in relief, rolling each over in my mouth like a mint. I archive as many as I can. My last one, palm reading in Tribeca. After aura photography, down on Canal Street, surrounded by crystals, somewhere beyond Tribeca, a shop front rises above us. Kismet. Ushered in, we brush against statues of the Buddha. The vibe is garden furniture chintz, peeling white cast iron, a monstera yawning over a tufted pink floral rug, the color palette screaming Lisa Frank. Look, there's a lot of beading everywhere. My friends ask for palm readings. I eyeball prices, quickly calculating that my tarot will be read by a friend for the price of a bottle of wine. Gillian is steered through tulle and incense by a woman whose face I cannot see to a room where reruns of Kardashians prattle, the volume unnerving. Seema is led forward by Jackie in her too many bracelets, placed on show behind the glass with the houseplants. I'm still here, perched on the iron seat between the front window and Buddha. The wine of Chloe and Courtney next door almost masks the low assurances of a strong male presence in Gillian's life. Her new girlfriend will be thrilled, I think, as I shift on metal, switching between stations. Jackie has none of the brisk charm of Canal Street. Her vocal fry sticks in my teeth, her bangles clicking as she takes Seema's hand. It starts easy enough. Lots of opportunities coming her way. Two great loves, great fulfillment. Jackie speaks such certainty of my friend's childbearing that I feel a bubble of laughter in my chest. I settle in for these gentle guesses of conviction. I see several pregnancies, but only two births. Do you understand what I mean? The patronizing comfort in her revelation pulls my laughter by its leash, pushing my hand to my mouth. So ghastly a loss flung out casually, bookended with warnings of a contract to read carefully. My fingers stick to the leather of my bag, willing myself into stillness until Jackie closes. Seema's eyes are wide as we shiver with laughter next to the beaded curtain, not really talking, just saying words to fill the air so as not to pry on Gillian's advice or think about dead children.
Thank you, Isabel. That was really vivid and wonderful. Next, we'll be joined virtually, well, I guess we're all virtual tonight, but we'll be joined by Jess McKenney, who sent in this video earlier in the week. As she couldn't join us in person tonight, but Jess is a poet from Innishawn, Donegal, and she completed her MA in poetry at Queen's University Belfast, where she is awarded the Irish Chair of Poetry Student Award in 2020. Most recently, she was awarded a place on the Daedalus Press Mentorship Program in 2021, along with the Seamus Heaney Centre Poetry Summer School in 2021. Her debut pamphlet, Weeding, will be published with the Hazel Press in September 2021.
Hello, my name is Jess McKinney, and I'm going to read two poems from my forthcoming pamphlet, Weeding, which will be out with Hazel Press at the end of the month. This pamphlet would not have come together in the same way if it weren't for the guidance of the tutors on the summer school, and also from all the wonderful feedback from my fellow students. So I'm going to read two poems from you, both in a similar vein and both rather damp. Suitably, the first poem's title is Dampen. Choked in darkness, the old canal boat aflame sailed by my window like a swarm of fireflies lighting up the pines. The sound of it warmed me out of bed, quiet as a night blaze. Slow on saltwater creek, hiss-spitting and heavy with damp, anointed in kerosene and surrounded by forest-singing evening, rural noise without wind and pale lunar moths encircle. As if my heat dreams had sprung to life, wheezing, idleness is a form of dying. New thoughts to burn the old, illuminating the pairs just forming, flushed like a palm in the act of grasping. I gather what needs to be gathered, knuckles cracking against the night. Thoughts never far from the children born as fires burn, into a world where everything is hopeful enough to make your throat ache. Thank you. And for the second poem I wanted to read this evening, is called Jetsam. We were taking on water when I woke, sinking into the still lake made strange for all its sea water without a source. The anchor was already over, so I kept searching for something else to lose, some divine logic to pull it all together. Next went the compass, then the sails, crates and barrels, foghorn and paddles, the rudder, tackle and bait, lobster pots, driftwood, wattle and swab, sheep shank, cleat hitch and carrack bend, the cutting wind choking roots and bags of sand, your cormorant grace, sea legs, divining rods, lost language, wet symbols, stars fished out of the sky, the hard shoulder, perfect shade of the storm, proof of address, confirmation names, dried up words funneled into bottles, what was hidden, sewn into coats, decades of the rosary, knots of dabber luck, the line in the road, the times we touched, armfuls of yellow gorse reflecting your face lowered into the dark, the residue, the constant moon, fluent wings of the deserting creatures I envied, memories certain and not so, each drop in the water a small cherished christening, the stones from my pockets, even the hags with their perfect holds, each one a turning point, even the one with your name on it. Finally, my own hands, what I was left with, and what I was trying to get at.
Next, we will be hearing from Lucy Dogen, who is a writer and translator based in rural Brandenburg in eastern Germany. She's currently working on a queer family saga set in a ruined manor house. She is the author of Tendrils with Cambridge Peer Press, published 2014, and a novel about long-lost enemies.
I'm going to read one really short poem and one much longer one. And the first poem is called Check Green. Scared, 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 says Ruth, small, as we walk down the steep slope. Hedvika dances, middle sister, outdoors in the dark with a torch. Hedvika, stop showing off. A wild wind blows, the sheep are hiding, the borders are closing. Marushka, the oldest, finds a stone, dark, soft. The sisters crush it, making green paint. So the longer one is called Family Calendar. I write to Eva about the moon and to Aurelie about mushrooms. Each month, the mushroom shifts in the sky and cooks itself. A year is whisked. Moon after moon rises pale in a bowl in the kitchen. The kitchen is a nest of swallows. One turns its head to the wall, startled and speechless, while the other splutters with indignation at the sight of human beings trying to stop migrating, roosting on muddles of remnants. Remnants of beams hold the roof tiles, turning to dust at the touch of a question, whose tree is being drawn? Stones were stolen to found the walls. Nothing here was made from scratch. Scratch my title on the door. I am a member of the calendar, a month of the family. There is the month of clay, layered and translated, the month of piano keys planted in the evening, and the month of bees, which don't sleep, just remain very close to each other. To each other, we are a winter of few words. We swarm through 12 dimensions, marry in unknown orbits, and know it is not legitimate to speak this path at all in words which fall, certain as the fur of snow which starts to trace my outline. My outline is home to so many voices I don't know. Buzzards, bats, cuckoos, house martins, a stork. I should have learned earlier to count my words. I grow a certain number, a stock like poppy seeds, waiting to be sent in envelopes to Pascal's friends. She leafs through the kitchen dictionary and laughs. At the center of the year, here we are, curled like commas, sliced and stacked like dashes, cracked and smoked like brackets left scattered. I hid the words in the buried ice house, unearthed 12 silences. Laughs and coughs and nestles sprouting syllables into the layers of sheep's wool under the windows of the library, determined to make the room warm and multilingual. Pascal is always fluttering against the glass, stubborn as an outraged butterfly waking too early from hibernation. Hibernation gives us time to count. How many mothers would you like to have? What will you name them? How will you teach them to be kind? I tried to make new hinges for my windows and new fingers for the strings which are stretched across the center of the instrument. The instrument which wakes me is a knife on straw, a blade to mix clay, a spade shoveling sand from the place at the edge of the woods, slap of hands smoothing the caked walls, quiet as they dry and breathe, keep some creases, silent letters. Letters send me back to the tree. It is disobedient. Blackthorn blossoms from the same shoulders that hold bramble flowers, brick dust, broken secateurs, and rusted histories. The local papers warning of wolves, all unrelated, sprouting from aching blades. The blades are blunt as we wait for the owl to come back and sharpen them. In the park, deer are barking. Our garden is their larder, charred for starters, rosebuds for dessert. One night we go in search of wolves. It's a game, but I believe it. I feel better. We find none, and Nina bakes crescents. Crescents hold the words I dropped, brackets cup, the unknown faces. I forgot that the moon would be eaten again. I forgot that I couldn't prove anything. Still, I take this title. Why family? Because we stored the walnuts, tiled the floor. Why calendar? Because I measure twice and then I write.
Thank you, Lucy. Next, we'll be hearing from Ashley Elizabeth Best, a disabled poet and essayist from Kingston, Canada. Her work can be found in New Welsh Review, CV2, Ambit Magazine, Grain, and Glasgow Review of Books. Her debut collection of poetry, Slow States of Collapse, was published with ECW Press, and her most recent chapbook, Alignment, is available from Mahalia's Ghost Press.
So I'm going to read three poems. The first is called The Other Tenant. The woman below us bumps around her kitchen drunkenly. At noon, she launches fireworks from her living room window. She wants to be left alone, but the more the year relaxes, the more her grief returns, like the birds to the old tree stump. My mother taught me well. Always have something set aside for when your loved one beloved leaves. She's disabled, had 5 mouths to feed, 6 if her bird appetite is counted. I can't remember her ever eating with us. Whatever was set aside always had to be paid back. The woman downstairs argues with her ex on the phone about her children, the ones taken from her when she went to jail. Another firework hurls itself from the neighbor's window into the parking lot. I didn't have money set aside when my ex left. I too have hurled my grief from above, a mattress from a balcony. The door slams shut and my neighbor shuffles out to the grass. In one hand, a cold shot, and the other, a dead budgie. She struggles free of her sweater and lays in the dampening grass. Tonight, I watch as she holds her beer skywards, treading the last stretch of light. This next one is called Something to Believe In. The police made him leave his car when they took him to the hospital. He insists nothing is wrong, in between assertions of his superpowers, his ability to predict the future, and how we have destroyed him. He used to love his baby beyond any doubt. The frills of her dresses would leave indents on his knees. He bought her a pink acoustic guitar and took her to the movies. How kind it made him as they played video games, eating popcorn by the handfuls, her front teeth missing, their hairlines matching. Yesterday, my brother told his 10-year-old daughter he wants a DNA test done, that she isn't his. Have a good life. Her face mirrors his in childhood, the tornado spiral cowlick, her nails bedded into the flesh of my knee. Last summer, he left the guitar in his car at Azair's parking lot, heat cracking the fine body, music no longer reverberating the same way. And this last one I'm reading is called August. The day is at my throat again. Wind wakes to rattle branches overhead. We haul fallen wood, widowmakers, from the forest onto the lawn, dry and ready to catch. I toss mice guillotined by traps into the pile of wood I have tried to name the fallen trees like my grandfather taught me. Undress for the leaves, sap cemented into the lifelines of my feet. Someone told me to stop including the moon, to refrain from drafting landscapes into the architecture of my poems. Face what you're feeling. I feel better watching a bullfrog devour a smaller rival. I place meaning into the object and watch it burn brightly. It is a kindness I can offer myself.
Thank you. This recording is from Rebecca K. Morrison, who is a teacher and writer based in Berlin.
But the worlds, after Ingeborg Bachmann. I've fallen in love with a mountain village in Switzerland, with the taste of goat in the Cretan dusk, a hut trembling by Lawrence's winter shore, you and the frozen waves of the Baltic, Berlin songs, the smell of your back, kissing the slant of your mouth upwards, your Marlborough lights. From our balcony I blinked at the slow Kreuzberg swirl. Frank of the wine shop, Isadoro, the bookseller, the rest. I smiled, for you set me a shadowy glow. The alarm for my joy was the turn of your key in the lock. The photographer. Even as I dozed, you'd snap, my skin pinkening beneath the sun, the blunched bones made the shrubs draw into themselves and the hummingbird more fragile, more brilliant. You taught me to invite the elements in, to open my body to the heat of the sun, that rasp of sand, the silk of a pool by moonlight. The chill gnaw of water as coyotes pass on a howl, one to another, until the night is theirs, and we superfluous as tumbleweed or a lizard's discarded skin. Styrian Schloss. At the home of the Orientalist, Count von Hammerpurgstall in Austria. A window onto tall trees and the grey browns of autumn, a birch leans at an inquisitive angle. The skirting board is chipped, the stucco flaking glamour. The Baron was drawn to warmer climes, his castle peopled with memories of the other. Carved white cranes preen stone feathers. The sweeps and curls of language from the east welcomed to the drafty halls and cavernous chambers, four-poster beds, exotic beetles of scarlet and crimson. Chandeliers cast shadow, scratchings of gold paint, glass beads roll. The tapping dampness granted entry seeps into stonework and brocade. The warm heart of the kachel oven is memory too. The fourth and last poem, Ménherbe, which is a village in the Luberon region of Provence, not so far from Avignon. Ménherbe. The road to Ménherbe led to unexpected treasures. The first lizard of the season slid from the crack in the chapel wall. A rabbit too, not the tweed-knit greys of the vineyard, but a Parisian lapin. All elegance in black and white. A pair of stone lions guarded the ghosts of the nunnery. The early season hovered, chill, and we five had the run of the place. Lions, rabbit, lizard, girl.
Next, we will be hearing from Linda Hewitt, who works in communications as a copywriter and publications editor. She lives in Ballymena, Northern Ireland.
Hi, everyone. I have three poems for you tonight. The first one is called Meeting My Mother-in-Law. Moss, lichen, birchet, thyme obscure the chiseled details that death chooses to remember. Instead, I wish this headstone had a QR code that I could scan, projecting onto this hallowed stage a hologram, or at least a playback of when you were alive, so I could see your 6-foot frame in all its glory, or if my daughter's unfamiliar slant of nose mirrors yours, or if the way your son soldiers on comes from somewhere in your story. From the few aged photos, you look nice, kind, softness and burnt sienna eyes. But maybe you don't want to relive those days. Maybe it's easier if your memory fades rather than pixelates. He's doing okay, your son. He's doing just fine. Moss, lichen, birchet, thyme. This one is called First Blood. You came into my room, legs shaking, face pale like china plate. Your entry into this no man's land of womanhood, forced and uninvited onto this clean cotton blue sky day. Yet brave, only a decade old, and you're eager for the virtues extolled on those whose bodies leak life like the moon sheds light. In that moment, I want to halt time, make the world spin Widdershin, curse the feminine and bleach away the blood brown stain of sexuality that ripens in your womb. Instead, I wrap you in my arms and soft plumes of natal down dislodge between my fingers. And this final one is called The Story. When they boarded up the library, the books, accustomed to this annual summer ritual, respond accordingly. Jane Austen yawns and stretches, then settles onto a chaise longue. Andy McNab stands guard by the door should defences fail. And a collaboration of science books calculate the probability of catching fire given distance from the heat. In the kids' section, small books with big feelings shake as parenting guides tell them it's okay to be afraid and that prods sit on gods, just like dogs sit on logs, cats sit on mats and pumas sit on satsumas. The YA section doesn't really care, except for the carousel of goosebumps whose spines tingle in anticipation of what the night might bring. Over by romance, optimistic chick lit titles wonder if it might all end with firemen, yay, while the Book of the Year nominees worry their gilded front covers won't shine without day. Right at the back, the history aisle sighs in weariness, weighed down by tomes on nation building, written to document our inability to learn. Of those coded to the dark ages are the quietest. They remember the smell of singed parchment, the pain of pages curling in the heat, and how letters tangle, a necklace of ascenders and loops rising into flame. When a journalist asks how much it costs and who pays for Tullycarnet Library to be protected from the adjacent blaze, the guardians of the books email each other. Best not say anything. We don't want to become the story.
Thank you, Linda. Next, we'll be hearing from Elizabeth McGowan, who is a Pushcart Prize nominated poet from Belfast. She has been published in journals including Banshee, Abridged, and Rig Welter. As a spoken word artist, she has been a finalist in every All-Ireland Slam since 2016. And represented Northern Ireland in the Hammer and Tongue UK Slam Championships in 2019 and 2021 at the Royal Albert Hall. She won the current International Festival of Literature Spoken Word Platform 2019. She is funded by the Arts Council of Northern Ireland and the University of Atypical to work on her first book, which will be published by Verb Poetry Press in 2022.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to read two poems. The first one is short, the second one is longer, and the first one includes some mentions of insects, just to let people know in case that's something that you don't want to hear. I'm telling a friend I am writing to an insect theme, and finding out months later she has assumed I meant maggots. But maggots do not cross my mind at all. The plump, rot-seeking them of single mind, fat, little white and wriggling shits with gall, but maggots do not cross my mind at all. First time you find a dead bird held in thrall, turn over corpse, the bird's eye sockets blind, but maggots do not cross my mind at all. The plump, rot-seeking them of single mind, death should be still, not undead, filled with things which almost serve to stand the bird upright, excited, bubbling underneath the wings, death should be still, not undead, filled with things. Beak opens for a squawk. This dead bird sings a music jelly filled, so moist this blight. Death should be still, not undead, filled with things which almost serve to stand the bird upright. What are your stories? What came before you? What do the rocks say? What are the legends, she asks, eyes full of hope for Ireland of old, for myths. And you who got a proper education, who read required books, who libraried since birth almost, you do not know. The stories of the swans or of the hags, someone a looking glass, someone was cast a spell upon him, maybe he grew old, someone took revenge too, they always do. You think there's green, there's always green right here under our feet, but what to tell the girl? These half-formed thoughts, these half-remembered wisps, you never read, you weren't prepared for this, and this sweet girl from auntie uncle place wants to be told the stories, and all you can think is, I have nothing to tell you. I have nothing to tell you until bloody it appears. The only one you know or half know, the man, the hand, the politics, two warriors, two men, a land dispute, a race so male, the first to lay his hand on God's green earth to claim. They swim towards the land, one man seeing that the other has speed. The drive, the sheer technique through water moves as fish. He takes a sword or knife or teeth that parts unclear and hacks off whole his hand. It moves, it changes side, some right, some left. The flags cannot agree and throws, despite the pain, despite the blood, and throws it to the shore, securing Ulster's fate. And yes, today the hands on flags, on emblems, on dark street corners, men with thick wool knit to cover face show badges. It's painted on the walls 15 feet high, the hand, the land, who owns the ground we walk upon, the swimming race long past, so too the bombs, not such the fight, the hawk, the spit, the endless internet of it, the flags. The flags, the what aboutery, the if Michelle, then wrong, then always wrong, the spectre, it looms large, the other side, no better, worse, you murdered kids, she screams, ignoring skeletons in cupboards of her own, do not raise up, or celebrate these thugs, they say, while kissing theirs, while naming parks for them and burning wood with names, flags, yes, again, with names, daubed on with paint, with pain, it's 50 years, 50 since that and 40 still since dawn, the one, the other thing. They all are things, they all are hands, they all are bloody in the water, drawing sharks who come from far, come from across the sea with words laughing with tanks. Para 1-2, fix eye on target, laugh and pull the trigger, no report. For soldier A or B or F, the years they pass. The people who did things, the people die. More people then are born, they learn to tweet. The cycle then repeats, repeats itself. You tell her small. The smallest version of the sanitized, and she sits satisfied while you realize you do not know the stories, only blood. You do not know the legends, only thugs. I have nothing to tell you. I have nothing to tell you. What do the rocks say?
Thank you, Elizabeth. Our next poet is Daniel Bresland, who is a writer of poetry and prose fiction, and a postgraduate student at Queen's University. He lives in Ardigarvan, County Tyrone.
Hello, I'm going to read two poems tonight. And one of them, the first one is one that I presented at the summer school, and I've worked on since with some of the feedback There's a lot of it, but, and then the second one is a newer one. So I'm going to start with a poem called Mount Errigal. No motes disturb the sunbeam pigmenting his head, as firm on his shoulders as Errigal is on the horizon. He stares at a point in the haze that is uncertain why he picked it, as he makes time wait, like Joshua praying for the sun to petrify until the battle was over. This head is like a dried log with many rings through it and the odd knot. I take the razor to fashion a youthful cup. Silver millimeters create motes in the sunset's sunbeam as they glide to the tiles. I try to see my instrument not as an implement to destroy like an axe, but rather a whittling tool. He wears his high priestly garment of a barber cape, and I set to the business. My work is not merely fashioning, but more like a Joshua prayer. And then this second poem is a little bit longer, and it's newer. This one started out as a kind of poem to a character from the Moomin Troll books, and then became something quite different the more I drafted it. And it's called Ararat. When that flood arrives, the last air bubbles flee the buildings. Errigal dips under the black like a christening. The terracotta moon becomes the sky, refracted on the waters of the faces of the deep, and they gurgle ever further up. The only sound left is the sound of trickling, and your home has washed away again, bobbing near the top of the dome. Then I imagine that I will meet you there in the ruined manse on Ararat, hollowed to its outer walls where the beech trees grow, their limbs reaching up, pawing at the waterline. Up there, perhaps, we could try again, perched on the stone wall. The split beech pods cling to our feet and the water feels higher up our legs. Maybe I'd mention the weather and you'd nod and we wouldn't bother when the water meets our bellies. The worst part about broaching the matter of insurmountable obstacles or the reams of back and forth and back and forth, the arc would float on by and the flood would prevail beyond our two necks and slosh around our chins. Then we both just make do with small talk. Water and chit-chat and Ararat would be all that remained.
Thank you, Daniel. Our final reader tonight is Bernie Crawford, who originally from County Limerick now lives near the sea in County Galway. Her poetry has been published in Irish and international journals and anthologies. This year, her first full collection, Living Water, was published by Chaffinch Press. She was the winner of New Irish Writing in the Irish Times in January 2020, the Northwest Words 2019 Poetry Competition, and 2017 Poetry Ireland Trocaire Competition. A chapbook with a selection of her poetry was published by the Blue Nib in 2018, and in 2019, she was awarded a bursary by Galway County Council to work towards a debut collection. She is a co-editor of the popular poetry magazine Skylight 47.
The first poem I'm going to read is Canto, and then I'm going to read two poems from my collection. Canto. And then suddenly you're 65, and you're still planning to plane those floorboards, strip back layers of lacquer, restain them with translucency. That would involve moving the furniture, and you haven't found a space for the heavy stuff. In the trees around the house, you discover shelter, except when the wind blows from the west and funnels through your narrative, edging every pear leaf with black windburn. The elders all lean in one direction now. And that hammock at William Duffy's farm, the wash of sun after rain, fruit bubbling on the stove, lines of sparkling jars. But you preferred the wild taste of red ripe raspberries. And in another version, you did marry. the foundland of motherhood. How I envied those laughing women who came into the coffee shop after their mums-to-be yoga class in their bright multicolored clothes. I pictured myself in purple tights with layers of black and white cotton tops wrapped around with long scarves and my belly swelling week after week. All that doesn't matter now. I didn't have a swollen belly wrapped in colorful cloths, but I swathed you in a yellow shitenge and carried you snugly on my back. You pressed your right cheek and your two tiny fisted hands between my spine and shoulder blade. Your ears sought the lub-dub, love-dove of my heart. I felt your heart beat too as you tuckled down into your woven amnion. Together in the long afternoons, we walked under mango trees, rested in the handcrafted wicker chair to the buzz of bees busy with falling guavas. In my 20s, I went to Lesotho in Southern Africa teaching, and this poem is about the morning I left to go to Lesotho, and it was such an adventure and also so terrifying. Leaving for Lesotho. My father gave his nod to the morning. He'd shaved, wore the trousers of his second best suit. Was it already flapping a little loose? His braces over a portly shape, a deep wine of summer shirt. He wasn't traveling to the airport, said he'd let my mother go with me. Before we left, I went out to him. He was fixing netting over fruit bushes to stop jackdaws from taking his harvest. It wasn't his way to say much, but he offered me a fistful of freshly picked juicy goose gobs. Our mouths, full of their redolent taste, we walked together to the front steps to take photos. Later, much later, I went over and over what I could have, should have said. Instead, I reached up and flicked a piece of newspaper from his face. He must have nicked himself while shaving. We posed, his hands casually nesting my shoulders there on the top step where we recorded all our comings and goings. He came as far as the gate, said he knew I was well able to look after myself, but still, I turned to wave from the car. That was the last time I saw him, standing under the bough of roses, wiping his face with the back of his hand.
Thank you, Bernie, and thank you to all the rest of our poets. It's been really wonderful to hear you all read tonight.
The Seamus Heaney Poetry Summer School is led by Professor Nick Laird. The online showcase event was hosted by Poetry Assistant Elizabeth McIntosh. This episode was produced by Connor McCafferty and Rachel Brown, with thanks to Nick Boyle for his music. Special thanks to all our Summer School poets.